I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com. I bought your pepper. I bought your salt.
Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by Sam Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring people back to what's great in food, culinary traditions, cooking at home, knowing your farmer, or even growing your own food. I spotlight good food fighters and the culture of the good food movement, from chefs to tastemakers to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking Juneteenth and the 75th episode of Hot Grease. If you're listening live to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network and you have any questions or any comments, feel free to give us a call. Our number here live in Bushwick is 718-497-2128. What is Juneteenth? On the phone to answer the question and talk food of the African diaspora. Is Rachel Finn. Rachel is the founder of Roots Cuisine, an organization dedicated to Black foodways around the globe. Rachel, welcome to Hot Grease.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Rachel, would you say that the Juneteenth celebrations are still very underground?
I don't think so. I think people are more and more aware of them now. I think particularly in the last few years, maybe like the last 5 years, people are know that the holiday exists. They're starting to learn more about what actually happened, and I think, you know, periodically you'll see articles in newspapers or magazines or little blurbs or something about Juneteenth. So I think that it's a little bit more, it's not, I mean, certainly everyone doesn't know about them, but it's much more common or much more, I guess people know a little bit more these days, yeah.
So let's jump back. Please explain the origin of Juneteenth, how, where, when, and where it's currently celebrated.
Okay, well, so Juneteenth is actually, it wasn't, the date, I should say, is June 19th. It's celebrated every year, June 19th. And it first was actually, the 18th and the 19th were days back in 1865 at the end of the Civil War when the Union troops, June 18th, Union troops moved into Texas, Galveston, Texas, where they were still sort of enslaving Black people. And on the 19th, he read a proclamation that officially emancipated the slaves. Well, they had been officially emancipated in 1863, but the news didn't reach the area until 1865. So people didn't really know that they were no longer enslaved. So when the Union troops arrived, they were officially, they knew the business then. They were given all the information and slavery was done in that area. So And it's celebrated by and large throughout the United States, and in some countries it's celebrated, in some foreign countries it's celebrated, but it's largely an American holiday, and it's a state holiday in Texas, and I've learned that it's a state holiday in a few other states.
Yeah.
Maybe like 25 or 30 other states, it's a state holiday as well. It doesn't necessarily mean a day off for people, which is what people usually think, but it is recognized as a state holiday in a few different states in the country, throughout the country.
So I'm going to close my eyes as you describe the kitchen table on June 19th in the early 1900s in Galveston, Texas. What were people eating?
Well, first, I think, I mean, there certainly may have been, in people's homes, private homes, there may have been, like, special dinners and things like that. But Juneteenth is usually, like, a community celebration, towns, large gatherings of people. And, you know, in a park or, you know, at a church or something, and people would sort of prepare various dishes that I guess today we sort of connect or we would call like soul food, basically. So, you know, fried chicken, I'm sure there'd be plenty of barbecue, there'd be, you know, pies, cakes, potato salad, beans, okra, all kinds of things that, you know, we traditionally, black-eyed peas, things we traditionally associate with black southern cooking. Greens, all of this stuff is like popping into my head now. Cornbread, all of those kinds of things. And I'm sure like regional specialties as well. So, you know, whatever and large quantities of it, because you're feeding all this group of people that is gathered to celebrate emancipation, really, and to sort of connect and even sort of pay homage to people who had come before and look to the future and transmit, you know, values, belief systems, and just support each other, really, in this sort of new life.
So
this
if folks,
new life and freedom.
So if folks are listening and they're thinking, maybe I should plan a dinner to commemorate Emancipation Day, should one be a purist or should one fancy up the dishes of the African diaspora?
Well, I don't know. I think it's because I kind of view these celebrations or this particular celebration as something, again, I think it's all your preference. I mean, I think it's great to have sort of the fried chicken, the barbecue, all of the things that we traditionally link with black southern cooking. But I think it's like whatever in your community, whether it's like your community of birth, your family, your church, your town, that you're celebrating it together. I think whatever is sort of special and, you know, something that you feel, a dish that you might feel good about, you should, that's what you should prepare. So I mean, you know, if you love Jamaican food or you love Dominican food or Puerto Rican food and you also love fried chicken, well, make your fried chicken and make some tostones or make your rice and peas and put it all together on the table. And you know, I mean I really think that it's a time to celebrate heritage and what makes maybe your family, your community unique, as well as like those ties that connect us to sort of the history of slavery, the history of, you know, and emancipation, of course, throughout the country.
So besides Juneteenth, what other widely unrecognized black food feast should people know about? I say feast or more so celebrations that food is essentially the focal point.
Well, I think that because like food is so important in the throughout the black community anyway, just about any gathering, any family gathering, any holiday becomes like a feast, a food-focused feast. And but I do think things like family reunions, family picnics, for instance, and we had mentioned before the church homecomings. Those things are always, I mean, you know, for the church homecomings, for instance, there's a focus on obviously the church, worship, religion, God, yes, but food is such an important part of it. And for those family reunions, food is such an important part because I think it's sort of like a, I don't know, I almost feel like it's a cultural tie that sort of, like anywhere you went in any part of the country, you could be, if you were black and you went to different parts of the country, you know, maybe things were a little bit different, maybe regional culture was different, but, you know, there were certain foods that you could count on having, and, it, you know, throughout the South, or, and even, you know, in the North, of course. So I think, like, food becomes such an important part of all of those celebrations because it really does connect, not just the black community, but any community, really. So, I don't know. I don't think, you know, there's any, those two that I mentioned, of course, but any celebration is food-focused, I think, in the black community.
Totally.
Really.
There are so many things. I think the church homecoming is a huge one. It's people who are listening, who are familiar and from the South, the homecoming is big. I think college homecomings and traditionally, particularly at historically black colleges and universities, becomes a huge thing in terms of barbecues. And so those are some of the things that I was thinking about, kind of unrecognized foods.
Right.
We're going to take a short break, Rachel, and come back with more of Black food ways around the globe. Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check out our program schedule and show archives on heritageradionetwork.com. We're chatting with food writer Rachel Finn. Rachel's work has appeared in Gastronomica, Encyclopedia of Food and Culture, and Chicago Sun-Times. Rachel, you traveled all over the world and written extensively about food. Do you remember when the idea of creating roots cuisine popped in your head?
Yes, I do, actually. I had been writing, it came after a stint living in France, and I come back and I was doing some food writing. And I got an assignment to do an article for the Sun-Times. I pitched this idea of the food of African diaspora throughout Chicagoland to the Sun-Times. And while I was researching, I encountered a number of people who, I was learning, I was becoming more and more interested, and seeing these ties to the food of African food and the tie West African food, I should say, and then ties between different dishes, you know, from Brazilian to, you know, African American to Jamaican to Puerto Rican, Colombian, and I was really surprised that a lot of people either, you know, were really unwilling to accept that, you know, maybe Western African food and traditions had influenced their cooking. So they would say things like, you know, I went to a Jamaican restaurant and a woman told me that the cooking was very English and Scottish, and she didn't really see, you know, that connection. And, you know, in Belizean restaurants, people, you know, people didn't know, and in African American restaurants and like diners and stuff, they had no idea that, you know, they cook beans similarly in Brazil and in Jamaica, similarly to the way that African Americans do in the South. And so I just thought, wow, like, this is, it's so rich, and the food is so delicious, and people know so little about it that I think this needs to be done.
Uh-huh.
So I started doing it.
So you just returned from Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
What did you discover about Turkish people and people of color or black people in Turkey as it relates to food?
Well, I actually met a group of the Afro-Turks, as they're kind of known. There's actually an association of Afro-Turkish people, and people live throughout Turkey, but generally in and around Izmir, which is on the Aegean Sea. And I learned that similar to African-Americans, and people throughout the Caribbean and Latin America, that a lot of the Afro-Turks, their ancestors were brought as slaves, of course, and they spent a lot of time in kitchens cooking. And
uh-huh.
So, you know, it made me realize that here again, you have this African influence on, to a degree, on Turkish cuisine, because, or of, you know, the cuisine of the Ottomans, because they're the people that are in the kitchen preparing the food very many times. They're sadly, I didn't get a lot of information about recipes. I didn't get a lot of information about some of, you know, maybe like traditional dishes among the Afro-Turks, because a lot of what they have, a lot of the past, the recipes, those kind of things have been forgotten because there's such a sense of shame there. And I was told that, you know, a lot of people sort of hide and they sort of try to blend in, and so you don't have like a, you know, as you have in the American South, where you have sort of black Southern cooking, where you can sort of really identify the dishes.
What were some of the foods or that the Afro-Turks are traditionally ate or prepared?
Well, again, you know, they couldn't tell me. I asked, and I really sort of observed, and I went through, and actually what I learned is that there are a few dishes that use greens. Like, they use a lot of collard greens in certain areas, and they use, which may or may not be a legacy of the Afro-Turks, because they eat greens a lot in Turkish cuisine. But then there are some dishes that use black-eyed peas, and that, I mean, there's no mistaking that. There are some dishes that use okra. Actually, okra is quite popular throughout Turkey. And, I mean, I think those two things, there's really no mistaking that African influence with black-eyed peas and with okra. But again, those are not like specifically Afro-Turkish dishes. Those are things that are sort of in the Turkish, you know, in Turkish cooking, in Turkish cuisine. And so, I mean, actually that's something that I've been doing a bit of research on and trying to learn more about, is kind of how those things got there and if there is a direct connection to slavery and the Ottomans and the Afro-Turks with those particular dishes.
So I love that on your website, rootscuisine.org, you have this bookshelf on there. And, you know, a lot of times I'm having conversations with people and people make you feel bad if you haven't read, like, you know, Charlotte's Web. So what books should every foodie have on their bookshelf or should have read by now about black foodways, if you could give us a few?
Well, I would say without a doubt that Edna Lewis, really anything by Edna Lewis, but her her taste of country cooking, which is sort of like the seminal work, I think, of Southern cooking, I guess, like African-American cooking. It's a, if you're not familiar, it's just a book that it really gives you this new perspective on the food of African-Americans, that it's not just fried chicken, ribs, greens, and chitlins, that it really is sort of a local. It was because, you know, the Southern past, African-Americans were really an agrarian people in the South as they worked in the fields. They ate with the season, so local, sustainable food.
What other titles beyond Edna Lewis would you recommend? You have a ton on your website.
Yeah, I would say I have a few. I have bibliographies. I would say one book that's not necessarily, it's not a cookbook, but it's an excellent book about the contributions of African Americans to food in the Atlantic world is just that. It's called In the Shadow of Slavery. It's by Judith Carney. I would say if you can get, there's a book by, I'm trying to remember these titles offhand here. For Latin American foodways, I would recommend, it's an older book published in the 70s, the late 70s. I'm pulling it up. As I'm thinking of that, I would say for Caribbean food, a book by Enid Donaldson, which is A Taste of Jamaica.
Oh, wow.
I would say, let's see.
We got to add Jessica B. Harris in there, all of her titles, don't you think?
Well, I mean, I do like Jessica. You know, her contributions, I think, have been really invaluable in sort of bringing the food of African people and African cultures to a wider audience, for sure. So I think maybe like the Africa cookbook, I like that particularly because it, I mean, it's not, it kind of focuses on a few countries in Western Africa and, you know, it's certain areas throughout Africa, but it is sort of gives you a taste of what there is there. There's the other book I was thinking of, I'm sorry, it's called The Flavors of the Caribbean and Latin America.
Uh-huh.
It's by a man named Alex D. Hawks, and it's completely out of print. It was published in 1978, but
wow.
It is fabulous. I mean, I found it to be really sort of really, really interesting and really informative.
So if listeners are listening, if you could just remind them one more time your website and they can see the complete bibliography, all of your books. And I think you have another website, too, that has a link to all of your personal publications and where you've written and all that. I think if you could give both of those, that would be great.
Right. So the organization's website is Roots Cuisine. Well, the organization is called Roots Cuisine, and the website is rootscuisine.org. And then my personal website, where you can view a list of my publications and kind of the stuff I've done, is rachelfinn.net.
Rachel, thank you so much. Happy Juneteenth, early Juneteenth. And thanks for coming.
Can I ask you, what are you going to have on your Juneteenth?
So I think, you know, I am going to invite a few people over and have like traditional Southern cocktails. And that's it. Maybe just some, I'm going to have people bring stuff. So
well,
I don't know.
That's what characterizes it too. It's kind of like a big potluck. So perfect.
Yeah. So that's what I'm going to do. So I'll make sure we do a cheers for you.
Oh, thank you.
Cheers
so
to
much.
You. Wish you were here. Rachel, happy Juneteenth. We'll chat with you soon.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, keep listening. One more segment of Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network.
There's a party going on right here, a celebration to last throughout the years. So bring your good times and your laughter too. We gon' celebrate your party with you. Come on now. have a good time.
Celebration.
We gon' celebrate and have a good time. It's time to come together. It's up to you. What's your pleasure?
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced and engineered by Jack Inslee. This program is being sponsored by, who is this? Oh, Sam Edwards of Surrey, Virginia, the great ham spot in Virginia. Let me give a Southern girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant, located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. It is also the location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. It's celebration time, y'all. Today's episode marks the 75th show of Hot Grease. Hand clap. I'm giving myself a hand clap. Woo, 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 woo. So I want to start off by giving a few thank yous and giving a brief story of Hot Grease. Very, very brief. Some people may know it. First, I got to thank Jack Inslee. I remember when I called him and like pitched the whole idea on the phone. My number one fan and supporter, Jack. Nat Wiener, who used to be here, is one of the engineers. Thank you to him. Thank you also to Patrick Martins, owner of Heritage Radio Network and Heritage Foods USA, for giving me the opportunity to be here on Heritage Radio Network every Monday at 3:30.
And I was just telling Adrian before how much better the show's gotten in the past.
I know, right? That's what I was going to tell people. So Jack, when I first started the show, the first two shows you were here, and then you left and went to Italy for like a month or so, right?
Yeah.
So you missed when I was really horrible. Well, you were there the first show, and the first guest, Michael Crupain. Shout out to Michael Crupain. He actually moved from New York. He's in Philly now. He has a blog called The Dairy Show. But the very first show, I had to have a glass of wine. I was so fucking nervous. Oh my God. I was nervous. It was horrible. I talked about the weather the entire segment. You remember that? It was really bad.
There were a lot more cue cards.
Yeah. I mean, now I don't even know why I have them, because it's like if I just freak out one day and I, you know, have a mental lapse, I need the cue cards. Boy, we've come a long way. And the first show, shout out. I'm doing a lot of shout outs. Meredith Mojuleski. Remember her, Jack? I don't know if you were in Italy when she came.
She was here, yeah.
Yeah, that was the very first show that I became confident.
Yep.
Yeah, I was confident. I was like, oh, I can do this. Because the only thing I did prior to this, close to radio, was the high school announcements in high school. Ha 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 ha. Funny, right? So reflecting back on 75 episodes of Hot Grease, first of all, I'm gonna have to say I am humbled by the people who listen. I really actually leave the show and think that only, you know, two people listen to the show, and that's Jack after the show is over to tag it and put it up, and then me listening to it again. But people actually listen to Hot Grease, and they tell me via social media or in person that, you know, they walked away with some very valuable tidbit about something about food. So thank you guys for listening. Listening to all of my red velvet cake rants. Don't you love those? Don't you love the red velvet cake rants? I really need to go back and count how many times I've said the word red velvet. And definitely all my brilliant food friends from New York City or Seattle, just like Rachel. She called in from Seattle. We've had people from the West Coast, Midwest, Georgia, whatever. They actually come on and give their views on food politics. Thanks so much for listening to them and welcoming them on the show. Also, too, listening to the latest food discoveries, doing the type and tell or the hot five segment. And even listening to Big Red, the chicken, live in the studio. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. 75th. Episode of Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Keep listening. We're going to make it all the way to 100. Yeah, yeah. We're going to make it all the way to 100. Have a big blowout party. But until then, as always, always take the road less traveled and join me next Monday live at 3:30 right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This story comes off of Market Wire. Totally Green enters the U.S. hotel market with Orca, O-R-C-A, Green Machine, installed at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston, Massachusetts. Totally Green Incorporated, a pioneer in organic food processing systems and compostable packaging alternatives, has installed its revolutionary Orca Green Machine at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston. Four Seasons Hotels have implemented the Orca Green Machine to establish on-site composting of organic food waste generated by its restaurant and cuisine services. The organic composter saves the hotel tipping or disposal costs. The organic refuse produced by the hotel no longer needs to be hauled away. The Orca Green Machine composts up to 2,400 pounds of organic refuse per day into harmless, nutrient-rich gray water that can be safely put into the sanitary sewer system. The Four Seasons Hotel staff deposits any organic food waste generated throughout the hotel's guest rooms and restaurants into the composting machine. This aerobic compost process complements Four Seasons' environmental mission to support sustainability by reducing the amount of methane-producing organic material that they send to landfills. Well, kudos to the Four Seasons Hotel chain, because everybody could do that if they wanted to spend the money. I thought that was a really interesting story. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Did you know we have a show entirely about cheese? Take a listen.
Well, I know this is it's horrible to do visual things on the radio, but if you were all sitting in the studio, you would see this wheel from late May is quite pale in color. It's it's a little bit, like a milkier, sort of a very soft yellow. And then the wheel from late June is quite golden and intense looking. It's a really deep, deep yellow. What causes that difference?
Well, I'm quite sure it's the grass. It's the keratin in the grass. And that's giving it that yellow color, not fat, but definitely coming from the pasture. Our animals are fed hay through the winter now. We don't use fermented feed because that won't work with our cheese. Mm-hmm. But so they're essentially grass-fed year-round with grain supplements.
If you like what you hear, Cutting the Curd airs every Monday at 4:30 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast or check it out in our archives. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.